From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, no plan B on the fiscal cliff and a nation in mourning for so many shot dead. A shocking massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, and a country, a president, grappling with its implications.
We can't tolerate this anymore. These tragedies must end. And to end them, we must change.
As families grieved, others took their anger to the National Rifle Association's offices in Washington, chanting shame on the NRA. And last night on the fiscal cliff, House Republicans rebuffed their Speaker John Boehner's Plan B, which would have asked just million-plus earners to pay more in taxes. Congressman Steve LaTourette, Republican from Ohio.
He can only play with the cards that he's dealt, and the voters have populated our conference with this set of representatives, and he does his best to work with them. But sometimes your best isn't good enough.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Rick Klein of ABC News, and On Point's Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What have you taken away from the Newtown shootings? What do you want to hear from the NRA today? And can Washington, will it take us over the fiscal cliff? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us this hour from Washington is Molly Ball, political reporter for The Atlantic. Molly, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Also with us from Washington, Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC News. Rick, welcome. Good to have you.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Molly, and Rick.
At 9:30 this morning on the one-week mark of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary churches across Newtown, Connecticut, rang their bells 26 times in remembrance of lives lost. Hear the first. Then a long 19 seconds before the second, and on, 6 minutes of bells in Newtown. We will look at that enormous story in this hour, but if I may, late last night we have this big development on the fiscal cliff in Washington. Molly, what happened here to John Boehner?
Well, everything fell apart. He had come up with this sort of very risky gambit, the so-called Plan B, a pair of bills, including one on spending cuts and another raising taxes for incomes over $1 million. He thought he could round up the votes to pass that tax hike. But at the end of the day, conservative Republicans were not willing to vote for a tax increase, and he was getting no backup for the Democrats. And late Thursday night, he pulled the bill and announced to his caucus and then to the world that he didn't have the votes for it. And they've left. They've gone home for Christmas.
Rick Klein, how do you interpret that rebuff by Republicans in Boehner's House of Representatives? Was it the higher taxes on million-plus earners? Was that it? Was that the red line that they were not willing to cross?
They had a perception that they were going to be voting to raise taxes. And for a large majority of Republicans, that is an absolute non-starter. It has been part of the Republican mantra for so long to stand up against any tax increase of any form, any size or shape. The fact that the Speaker went forward with this, even though it would have cut taxes for more than 99% of Americans, it was just unpalatable. And it results in a stunning defeat for the Speaker. Such a debacle, actually, that even the White House wasn't happy about it. You didn't have anyone spiking foot balls in the end zone after this. Even Democrats realize this is a major blow to the prospects of any kind of compromise, and it raises the question about whether anyone is in charge in the House of Representatives.
Jack, what do you make of this? I mean, early this week, there were being pieces put on the table, President Obama talking about raising taxes maybe on something higher than 250 plus, maybe 400, 450 plus. Speaker Boehner talking about, well, maybe on a million plus as he finally went. And then last night, he just couldn't pull it together. What does this mean, Jack?
Well, I think it throws into relief the crisis in governance that we face now and will for the next 2 years and probably beyond that. You know, there is a faction seeming to be a preponderant faction in the Republican House that regards dealing with the president, giving the president anything he wants on taxes, and I think we're going to find possibly on guns, as a kind of treason. The president alluded to this in his press conference when he said they just don't want to say yes to me on anything. And why is that? Well, It's partly because the culture of almost paranoidal exaggeration about the threat Mr. Obama faces is so strong in red state America. The representations of him as a socialist, as a Muslim, as a you name it. A lot of that has sunk in, and with Republican constituents, and the idea of dealing with him on any basis just seems like something that endangers the country.
Molly, is it really about the president's personality, or is it Republicans on the merits saying, wait, this is a tax hike. We want spending cuts. We won't go down a tax hike road.
I think a lot of it really is ideological. These are Republicans from conservative districts who, number one, really believe that tax hikes are a bad idea. But number two, were having their offices flooded with calls from conservative activists, were being threatened with primary challenges, were being called upon by conservative groups like FreedomWorks, the National Tea Party Organization, insisting that people tell their members of Congress not to vote for this. So they were hearing it from all sides, and it matched up with, I think, the ideological predilections of these very conservative members of Congress. That's what Boehner's majority is based on, is these members from very conservative districts who really believe that tax hikes are a bad idea.
You can hear that. Yesterday, this was Kansas Tea Party Congressman Tim Heelskamp, Republican, saying that the Plan B proposal of John Boehner just wasn't Republican enough, not Republican material, he says.
This is not Republican material, and I think that's probably why they wisely pulled the plug and says, okay, let's regroup. But regroup and reassess, you know, what exactly do Republicans stand for?
And here's the president, as the piece Sound Jack pointed out at a White House press briefing, this was Wednesday, among many other things, saying that it can't be just about working with him or not wanting to work with him.
They keep on finding ways to say no as opposed to finding ways to say yes. And I don't know how much of that just has to do with, it is very hard for them to say yes to me. But, you know, at some point, you know, they've got to take me out of it and think about their voters and think about what's best for the country.
Rick Klein, surely this is not about a personality thing, about the president. I mean, surely this is about policy, Rick.
I think it is. Of course, personalities are always wrapped up in politics. We shouldn't be shocked by that. But the president just said two things that are actually contradictory, potentially contradictory for a lot of members of Congress. If you think about your voters, keep in mind the Republicans just won control of the House at the same time that President Obama won the presidency for a second term. Many of these members were reelected overwhelmingly, 60% of the vote plus. As far as they're concerned, what their voters want is very clear. They do not want higher taxes. If you then take it out of that and say, well, what does the country want? Well, people tell pollsters over and over again, we want a balanced approach with some higher taxes on the rich, with some cuts in spending. But there is a disconnect there between the people that we have sent to Congress and the idea of doing something that actually works for the whole nation.
But Molly, you had Grover Norquist this week, as I understand it, kind of give, and this is the guy who gives the no tax pledge that people sign, saying, giving his sanction, his blessing to this higher taxes on million plus earnings. Did that mean nothing?
Apparently not. Apparently it didn't carry very far, especially when other conservative activists such as the Club for Growth, which unlike Grover Norquist's organization actually does spend money in Republican primaries and puts up candidates and pours millions of dollars into TV ads, the Club for Growth was against Plan B. So Grover was sort of a lonely figure on Boehner's side, and any backup that Boehner might have expected that to get him just didn't go far enough.
Amazing turn of events, and here we are. Just days now before Christmas and the end of the year, here was Senator Dick Durbin yesterday, Democrat, Illinois, thinking back to Thelma and Louise, 1991.
Remember the closing scene in Thelma and Louise? Rather than face the reality of what lies ahead, they hit the gas. That's what we're hearing from Speaker Boehner now. Hit the gas and go over the cliff.
Hit the gas. And here's John Boehner himself at a press conference this morning, a day after abruptly pulling his Plan B tax proposal.
I don't want taxes to go up. Republicans don't want taxes to go up. But we only run the House. Democrats continue to run Washington. What the president has proposed so far simply won't do anything to solve our spending problem.
Rick, are we hitting the gas and heading over the cliff, or is there still room here for something next week?
I don't know the exact metaphor to follow here, but I think everyone is going to take a couple of days off. So maybe they put the car in park or get to grandma's house for Christmas. And then I think people are going to reconvene probably around the 27th or the 28th. I'd expect the president to be back from his trip, his annual family trip. I'd expect the Senate, the House. That's right. I expect everyone to come back, maybe with cooler heads. There's still a window here. The new Congress actually doesn't start until January 3rd. There's still a chance for some kind of compromise to happen here. Once you go over the cliff, technically January 1st, there's ways to kind of go back and claw back without having calamitous consequences. So I think this, because it was such stark relief, the divisions inside the Republican Party, keep in mind Speaker Boehner is going to have to pass something in the House. He may not have to pass it, though, with many Republicans supporting it. Democrats would help him out on any kind of deal. So I haven't given up hope yet. I think things look very dark right now. There's two sides just talking past each other. But there is still the framework that's out there. And if you get into the guts of what these guys are talking about, we're not talking about enormous differences between the two sides.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. American massacre. No plan B, it turns out. Blame for Benghazi and more. Molly Ball of The Atlantic is with us from Washington. Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC News, is here, and our own Jack Beatty. So, Molly, just we'll go to Newtown, but just to wrap it for the moment on the fiscal cliff, do you see a scenario where John Boehner and President Obama could get back together next week and make something happen? You're saying maybe with a minority of Republicans plus a lot of Democrats? Is that feasible?
Yes, I think picking up on what Rick was saying before, there's two important reasons that this doesn't mean nothing can get through the House. Number one, these bills got no Democratic support. And I think Boehner expected that he would get at least a handful of Democrat votes, but Nancy Pelosi came out aggressively against it and encouraged her members to give it no support. Mm-hmm. If he had even a few Democratic votes, Boehner would have a much better hope of getting something through the House.
So you mean his plan B or a deal with the president?
Anything.
Well, but, I mean, the plan B, the White House was never going to embrace. They made that quite clear.
So it would have to be something, obviously, that there was at least some limited Democratic support for. And secondly,
I think there'd have to be actually much more than limited Democratic support, wouldn't there? Wouldn't there have to be overwhelming Democratic support? Which means it would be nothing.
To get overwhelming Democratic support in the House, yeah, but to peel off a few Democratic votes, it wouldn't have to be overwhelming. You could get some moderate Democrats, some members from swing districts without getting the entire Democratic caucus on board, I think.
Jack, can you see a scenario like that or something in the other direction, Jack?
Well, the trouble with that scenario is as you say, Tom, really it would take almost the whole Democratic caucus plus 20 or 25 Republican votes to get a compromise on the president's terms. And that sets up a real problem for the speaker. In the speaker election on January 3rd, the whole House votes, not just the Republican caucus. And if so, if all the Democrats vote against Mr. Boehner, that means that a very small number of Republicans, 30 or so, can, by abstaining or somehow affecting the vote, put another candidate in there. And so he really has very little room to maneuver. And if he goes ahead with the Democratic plan, that's going to be that's a bitter pill for his caucus to swallow, and it could well cost him his seat.
Rick Klein, who has the leverage in the week ahead, if it's to happen in the week ahead?
I think the president has more leverage up until the moment we really go over the cliff, maybe afterward as well. But the whole cliff was designed as a mechanism to try to spur action, but it was designed in an unequal way. And if you really get into the guts of it, Republicans dread the prospect of this happening more than Democrats do. So the idea of going back to the Bush-era tax rates for everyone wouldn't be the end of the world for many, many Democrats. So I think that still is there as a leverage point. And if we do go up with higher taxes after January 1st. We've seen it in poll after poll. Republicans are more likely to shoulder the blame. Certainly for their base, it is more unfathomable to have taxes go up for everyone. The president continues to say, look, just at least pass taxes for 98% of Americans, his point about the $250,000 plus. So I still think the president holds more cards in this. But, it's tough being in the White House and being blamed for something that everyone is acknowledging could cause a second recession.
if that's where the blame lands. The latest polls that I've seen don't show it necessarily going there at all. Well, everyone's going to take some heat here. It's going to be some series of days in front of us here. I want to turn back to the terrible, terrible shootings a week ago today in Newtown, Connecticut, and how that has reverberated through this nation. Here on Monday was Krista Rakos. Her 6-year-old daughter, Jessica, died in those shootings. She told ABC News she was still in disbelief early this week over what had happened.
It's still not real that my little girl, who's so full of life and who wants a horse so badly and who's going to get cowgirl boots for Christmas, isn't coming home.
That unspeakable grief, and the country just feeling it, some responding, all kinds of responses here. Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York saying we have too much gun violence in this country. Here he was on Sunday on Meet the Press with host David Gregory.
It only happens in America, and it happens again and again. There was another shooting yesterday. 3 people killed, I think, in a hospital. We kill people in schools, we kill them in hospitals, we kill them in religious organizations, we kill them when they're young, we kill them when they're old, and we just got to stop this.
Michael Bloomberg calling there for more gun control. The NRA will have its piece to say today as we speak. They have not yet spoken, but here on Tuesday, Fox News anchor James Rosen listed several ways the National Rifle Association, he said, planned to fight back against gun control advocates in the wake of the Newtown shootings.
The National Rifle Association, which has remained largely silent since Newtown out of respect for the mourning period, will soon start to, quote, push back against the very vocal gun control lobby. Industry sources say the NRA will broaden the discussion to include Hollywood and the gaming industry, and the group will challenge the effort already underway to restore the ban on assault weapons that existed from 1994 to 2004.
Fox News on the NRA. Let's hear from our listeners on this tragedy a week after. David in Stanton, Virginia. Thanks for calling, David. You're on the air.
Tom, thank you. Two overall points. First of all, school security. We need to have national laws requiring all schools to be secure against this type of violence. And the second thing regarding security is school buses. I live in the second largest land area county in Virginia. Mm-hmm. We have hundreds of miles of back roads that school buses travel. The next one of these is going to be an ambush of a school bus.
How do you secure all that, David? I mean, after all, Andrew Lanza shot his way in through the door, locked, as I understand, at Sandy Hook.
I don't know. You have to do it, though. I mean, we have to figure out a way to do it. There are schools in this country who have done that, who have secured their doors.
But we can't put all of our kids in armored personnel carriers, but I take your point and concern for the safety of the kids. And your second point, David?
Second major point is the gun control issue. I am 64 years old. I have 4 young grandchildren, 2 of whom are 6-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I grew up on a farm. I'm living on a farm. I grew up in the hunting culture. Gun control has nothing to do with hunting. The NRA, in my lifetime, has gone from a gun safety and training organization to a gun manufacturing lobbying organization. They are the most evil organization in this country. It is the NRA Firearms Industrial Complex. We need to have no half measures in this. We need to ban the manufacture, the distribution, and the ownership of these assault rifles and handguns for anyone except military and police, create an amnesty period for these guns to be turned into law enforcement, after which the owners would be subject to criminal penalties.
David, we've got it. There's a grandfather laying down a tough line on guns out of Virginia, and if I may, I'll bring it to you, Molly and Rick and Jack, but one more from Nashville. Christian is calling. Christian, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a mm-hmm. long-time listener and first-time caller. So
welcome.
Tom, I just recently joined the NRA. I'm 40 years old, and I never really felt the need to become a member. However, sir, and I'm heartbroken over this terrible tragedy that happened in Newton. I certainly am. I have 2 young nieces that are 10 and 5, and it breaks my heart, sir. However, hearing that people are going to lobby or argue against the NRA did not go and kill these children. It was a sick individual that killed these children. And it disparages over 4 million law-abiding NRA members, such as myself, plus millions of other gun owners that legally own their guns.
Yeah, Christian, may I ask, did you join the NRA before or after the Newtown shootings?
Before, sir. Before, about 2 months before, sir.
And are you sure that all 4 million members of the NRA support all the NRA's positions? I mean, you're right. They didn't pull the trigger in Newtown. That is quite true. But they fought very hard against the assault weapons ban. They fought very hard to keep from restrictions on high-capacity magazines, the kind that this killer used so that there was, you know, no pause in the killing as far as we can see. What about is there room for some negotiation or some change, Christian, or no?
Well, you know, sir, I appreciate the question. There is some room, and no, sir, of course not. Not every Catholic agrees with everything the Pope says, and not every NRA member agrees with everything that the leadership says. However, there has to be, as you know, in any organization or anything, there has to be some kind of standard to live up to. And within that standard, there can be some variation. The Second Amendment, I believe, sir, in my opinion, is very clear, that the citizens, free citizens, have the right to bear arms for their own protection.
But does it have to be, does AR-15s, assault weapons, or what about rocket-propelled grenades? What about missiles?
Well,
I mean,
assault weapons are per se, and I understand that the military, like AR-15s, they are originally military-type weapons.
Yep.
However, it does go back, and again, a lot of people may criticize, go back to the Founding Fathers, where free citizens frequently had better weapons than the British Army. This was to assure.
You're beyond my expertise right there, Christian. But we've got your perspective very clearly, and I appreciate it. And let me get one more, if I may. Mary in Simsbury, in Connecticut. Mary, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm a little disturbed over the fact that there's been a lot of emphasis on mental illness, and even bringing up Asperger's. And two of my sons who are in school in Connecticut have friends who have Asperger's.
Sure.
So I feel that there hasn't been enough emphasis on perhaps this person was just a psychopath, like, you know, all the checklists of Dr. Hare, which is openly available if you Google it and find out the list of the 20 checklists.
But isn't a psychopath kind of by definition somebody with mental health issues, Mary?
No, it's not a mental illness. That's the problem. It's a brain disorder. And it basically is, there's a big article in the New York Times about the work that they're doing with young psychopaths to try to get them on the path of understanding empathy and having a moral compass. If you go back a couple of months, it was in the New York Times.
So be careful with on the mental health front, and yet people are concerned there as well. We've got it, Mary. Thank you for your call. Let me go to our panel. Rick, you're in Washington, senior Washington editor for ABC News. Do you think that this tragedy in Newtown is going to significantly change American policy on pick your front? Start with guns.
Count me as a skeptic on this. Look, I've been through a number of these, none quite at this level with children involved. I think the reaction was unprecedented to see so many pro-gun Democrats come out and say we need a re-examination. The NRA's response was different than it's been in the past. But I do not see this as a moment that is going to vastly change the gun debate. I think it's possible that we push some legislation like an assault weapons ban, which lapsed in 2004, even though President Bush wanted it extended at the time. I think you could see some new legislation. But I don't think we're seeing a legislative shift on guns. I think this is still a gun-happy nation, and it's a gun-happy Washington as well that protects it.
You may be right. I don't know. Let's listen to some of those voices. I'll bring it to you, Molly. But this was Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, West Virginia. This was on Tuesday. Lifetime member of the NRA. He's been very strong on gun rights, but shaken by what happened in Newtown. Senator Joe Manchin.
I am a proud member of the NRA and have been. And I'm a lifetime member and will always be. I'm a defender of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. But with that being said, you know, we need to take a look now at who we are as a society, as a country, and how we protect those that need protected the most, which is our babies and our children.
Molly Ball, look at Capitol Hill. Do you see some change in the chemistry there that could lead to a change, significant change in American policy?
It's still an uphill battle for any kind of legislation to get through the Congress. We have heard some pro-gun Democrats changing their tune. We haven't heard any Republicans changing, and Republicans are going to have to switch sides for this issue to have a chance. At the same time, there is a real difference, a qualitative difference in the tone of this debate compared to past tragedies. The fact that this is the fourth time that this president has mourned the victims of a mass shooting, the fact that there were children involved, the outpouring of not just grief but anger that we've heard from people all over the country and from politicians in the wake of this, I think has really been different and has prompted the NRA to react differently. They have actually seen a need to respond now
rather than simply waiting it out as
they've done in the past.
But as we speak, we don't know exactly what that response will be. People may know by the time they hear this. Let's hear from a Republican, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie here. This was just yesterday, a town hall suggesting that there were, look, not just guns, many possible causes, he said, of the Newtown shooting.
I hope that what we do as a country now, after this horrible event, is to have a thoughtful conversation across the country about all of those things. If we focus on just one of them, if we focus just on mental health, or we focus just on substance abuse, or just on violence in the media and in video games, or just on gun control, we're going to miss the bigger picture, in my opinion.
Jack Beatty, how do you see what's unfolding here?
Well, the House of Representatives is a huge stumbling block. In the ABC Washington Post first poll they did post-massacre, only 29% of Republican voters supported tougher gun laws, 74% of Democrats. And that problem we were just talking about with the House districts, so conservative, so rural, they faithfully, in taxes and possibly in guns, reflect what their constituents want. Now, it's poison for the party brand nationally. Joe Scarborough says we're going to be the party of millionaires and Bushmaster, party of millionaires and Glock. Mm. But if that's what your constituents want in these rural districts, that's what the Republicans are going to reflect. And I do think it's ominous that you haven't had any even sort of crack in the Republican intelligentsia. In the National Review, they have a cover article basically saying, well, you know, this is what happens in a feminized environment, that the Sandy Hook School was a feminized environment.
What are they talking about?
Who knows what that means?
Women have been school teachers forever. We didn't always mow down our kids.
Right. But, I mean, if you're starting way out there, I mean, the chance of finding some, you know, practical measure on gun control is so difficult. And then even on the side of the nostrums, I mean, Democrats say let's ban assault weapons. Well, 323 people were killed with rifles last year, as against, I don't know, 13,000 for with pistols. And you know, then Dianne Feinstein said, well, of course we'll grandfather in current weapons. Some estimates are it would take 100 years to work through that supply of weapons.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, if we can look beyond the huge headlines there, but there are some important ones. Longtime U.S. Senator from Hawaii, Daniel Inouye, died at age 88. Here he is talking with NPR last year about receiving the Medal of Honor and his military service as a Japanese-American in World War II.
We had an extra burden because it was not only serving our nation in uniform, but also proving and demonstrating our loyalty, which I'm glad to say my country has said we did.
And he and many others certainly did. Big snows swept east across the plains and Midwest after last year's low snow winter. It got people's attention.
I've lived in Wisconsin for 10 years, and I think this is the worst one I've seen.
I'm not ready for it. I guess we're a little bit spoiled from last year, right?
And a long Mayan calendar turns over today. There was celebration near ancient ruins in Tikal, Guatemala. We're looking at a week in the news, American massacre. No plan B, it turns out. Blame for Benghazi. Senator John Kerry nominated, we're told, will be this on this afternoon, Friday, for U.S. Secretary of State. Molly Ball is with us from The Atlantic. Rick Klein from ABC News and our own Jack Beatty. Let's get a call from Savannah, Georgia, and Stephen. Stephen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I am a Republican in Southeast Georgia. Mm-hmm.
grew up in a hunting culture, own guns ourselves, have small children.
Mm-hmm.
These type weapons have no place in our society or in the field for hunting purposes. They need to be banned across the boards.
You're talking about assault-style weapons, I guess.
Absolutely. They have no place. And we grew up, my family's been in this area since 1620 with a hunting culture. None of my family or friends own any of these type guns.
What about the high-capacity magazines, Stephen? What do you think that hold, you know, so you can just shoot on and on and on?
Should be banned as well. When we hunt for deer, and we do hunt, we probably take a maximum of 3 or 4 bullets with us.
Mm-hmm.
These type weapons and clips have no place in society. They do not. And trust me, I'm a Republican in Southeast Georgia, and you will definitely hear argument from a lot of people over gun ownership itself,
mm-hmm.
but you will
sure.
not hear any arguments concerning assault weapons or clips.
Why do you think the NRA doesn't share your view, and why hasn't it been more heard among your fellow Republicans in Congress, Stephen?
Well, you can't just blame it on the Republicans.
No.
John Barrow, one of his advertisements through the political season, mm-hmm. had his grandfather's gun saying, "You would take them from my cold, dead hand."
Yeah, okay. No, fair enough. But your perspective then? I mean, why do you think it has not been heard more in Washington?
I think it has. A lot of my friends and family, and we are big landowners, we have a lot of friends, nobody is a member of NRA. You just don't see it down here. I don't know if it has to deal with the manufacturing of the weapons from money that's gained from the NRA from that standpoint.
Well, there's a lot. That's true.
You just don't see that type involvement in the southeastern portion of the United States.
Stephen, I appreciate your call today. I thank you very much for calling in, and the best to your family there. One more right here. Ann, and thank you, Stephen. Ann in Providence, Rhode Island. Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling with regard to the all-too-predictable shooting in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. I'd say I agree with your very first caller, Dave, the grandfather from Virginia, who called the NRA the most evil organization and dangerous organization in this country. I'd like to say that also Mayor Bloomberg is probably our most courageous politician. But unfortunately, I don't see this as changing the gun culture in this country, unlike in Australia, where they had a mass shooting in, I believe, 1999, and within a couple of weeks had put in place laws that banned assault weapons and resulted in a buyback of something like 300,000.
650,000 assault weapons bought back by the Australian government. Yeah, that's
right,
true.
And melted down. Unfortunately, the needle on public opinion in this country has not moved that much with regard to these killings. I think a few more people believe in banning assault weapons, but really, you know, we have this sort of 50-50 split, which I think is, you know, largely driven by the fear.
Well, you may be right on that front end, but I'm not sure. I think we're going to have to wait and see how this plays out in public opinion. This has been a real emotional moment here. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Brookline, Massachusetts. Pete is calling. Pete, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I've got 3 points to make quickly. Mm-hmm. First of all, when the Constitution was written in 1787 to 89, guns were completely different. They were one-shot weapons. It took time to reload the weapons.
Sure.
They didn't have rifling. They were completely different than the guns are now and much less accurate. The second thing is that they were used by hunting by almost everybody. So at that time, there was an expectation that everybody would have guns because it provided for food. And the third thing was that we had just finished a revolutionary war for our independence.
Mm-hmm.
It was the last time that the continental U.S. was under attack by a foreign nation in, what, 2 centuries?
Well, still, the Constitution's got the militia right in it. What about now? Do you see the country changing, Pete?
I see us having far more guns than is needed for the protection and safety. We didn't have a police force that we had at that time. We didn't have a standing army that we had at that time. So there was a lot less protection.
Pete, I appreciate your call as well. Jack, a final thought on this Newtown front. I mean, the sorrow has been unbearable to watch these families. I can't recall. There have been terrible, jarring moments, and there have been massacres. Virginia Tech and Columbine and plenty more. We all know the names. Something about these little children, 6 and 7, and, you know, up to 11 bullets in, you know, in some of them. I mean, there's something about the emotion here, Jack, that I just wonder if it may make people think again, or is it digging your heels time, Jack?
Let's hope it will. I mean, the enormity of the action. Anyone with children, anyone with human feeling is horrified. And there are some positive signs. People point out, you know, there's no national election for 23 months, so it's a pretty safe time for people to act. Also, there's a kind of accumulation effect. There have been so many of these, and this now seems the horrific capstone. Well, let's hope, at least for a while, to them. But it seems to sum them all up and to confront us with something we don't want to go on. Also, people have pointed out it's happened in Connecticut. One political scientist says this isn't Arizona, this isn't Virginia. There does seem to be a feeling, wait a minute now, Connecticut, that's in the east, that's a blue state, they have all sorts of regulation. If it can happen there, it can happen anywhere. I mean, all over the country this has happened. That line of Yeats's, you know, the ceremony of innocence is drowned in blood, that has happened again and again. And it may be that this is one of those moments, galvanic moments, when politicians can feel safe in following public opinion. However, there is that difference between the public opinion in rural red districts and in the country at large.
Well, but you heard Stephen calling in right there from Georgia. I mean, we've got other news. We need to look at it. Senator John Kerry coming up as Secretary of State, but the call's just flooding in. Let me get another Anchorage, Alaska. Warren, you're on the air.
My thought is that guns is all about controlling of guns. From the time a manufacturer makes a gun with a serial number that identifies the manufacturer company, that gun should be traced all the way from the manufacturer all the way to the owner, and it should be verified every year that that gun is in the hands of a person that has a safe a record.
I mean, this goes to registration, Warren, but of course we're selling a huge amount of guns in gun shows where there's not even any background check. So, I mean, but I take your point. People talk a lot about how do the manufacturers come in here? They're getting a lot of attention. And the NRA's relationship there, as one of our callers said. Warren, I appreciate your call. Frank in Hartford, Connecticut, back where, near where it happened. Frank, you're on.
Thank you very much, Tom. Mm-hmm. I'm retired military. And my profession for a number of years was that of a sniper. And I quite honestly am very tired of this argument that civilians make when they say, well, we need our guns to defend ourselves against a potential military takeover. They seem to believe that they're going to be able to outshoot somebody like me. And I got news for these people. If my Army Ranger unit were called in into a building to deal with a situation, you better have a hell of a lot more than AR-15s ready for us, because you're not going to exit that building.
So what direction should we go as a country, Frank, on gun policy? What do you think?
You got to take these military weapons. I'm trained to use this stuff. These people are not trained to use this stuff. They have no business having it. High-capacity magazine, that's ridiculous. Most sniper rifles have one shot. You either know what you're doing or you don't know what you're doing. You don't need to be spraying stuff all over. Ordinary civilians have no reason to have this stuff, period.
Frank, we've got it loud and clear. I'm going to turn right there, and I appreciate your call. Rick, Molly, what are you hearing in Washington about this? Apparently John Kerry will be nominated today as Secretary of State. There's a turn in the conversation. I guess at this point, Rick Klein, there's not really a surprise there.
There's not. Susan Rice, of course, was widely seen as the front runner. She took her name out of consideration last week, a consequence of the Benghazi affair. John Kerry, though, not the rest of the national security team yet. We're to understand that he'll be named by himself. We won't get a new Secretary of Defense or a new CIA director just yet. But I think Senator Kerry is going to be in a good place for confirmation. He was born to a Foreign Service officer. Obviously, his presidential campaign, his long service in the Senate as the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee most recently. I don't think he'll have a hard time being confirmed. And I do think he will be an effective advocate for President Obama and American interests abroad, given the celebrity that he brings to it, in a sense, but also the depth of his knowledge and understanding, the travels around the world. I think a very solid choice that I think is going to be viewed pretty positively by members of Congress on both sides of the aisle.
Molly Ball, do you see any hiccup in the likely Senate confirmation if it's Senator John Kerry?
No, not at all. One of the things that we heard during the whole Susan Rice controversy was John Kerry sort of set up as a foil to the controversy that would have surrounded her nomination by figures such as John McCain and Lindsey Graham, saying things like, well, John Kerry would have no problem getting through the Senate. Susan Rice, on the other hand. And I think, you know, we should point out this is really a happy ending for John Kerry, who has had some political setbacks in his career and who really, really wanted this. It sets up a great potential special election in Massachusetts and a possible second chance for Scott Brown after he lost
Republican,
last time around.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right. But no, John Kerry should absolutely sail through the Senate. I can't foresee a problem there.
Jack, I want to come to you on John Kerry. If we could just look at it for a moment through the lens of, I mean, we had these hearings this week on the American deaths at the consulate in Benghazi. Tough report that came out from an independent commission there, saying that there was failure at the State Department that led to the death of Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans in Benghazi. Then John Kerry came in. But here's on Wednesday, Admiral Mike Mullen, co-chair of the commission.
We did conclude that certain State Department bureau-level senior officials in critical positions of authority and responsibility in Washington demonstrated a lack of leadership and management ability appropriate for senior ranks in their responses to security concerns posed by the special mission.
Lack of leadership in senior ranks. We'll see how that may come back to touch or not Hillary Clinton, depending where she goes politically. The next day, it was Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts, chairman of the Senate Formulations Committee, overseeing a hearing on that attack and saying that underfunding of embassy security was partially to blame. Senator Kerry.
Congress also bears some responsibility here. Congress has the power of the purse. We use it for any number of things, but it's our responsibility. And for years, we have asked our State Department to operate with increasingly lesser resources to conduct essential missions.
Jack Beatty, there's the senator kind of jawboning for more resources for the department that it looks like he will now be lined up to lead. He's going to be adding. But a fair point. I mean, there have been cutbacks on exactly the front that ended up biting us.
Yes, of course, the Republicans come back and they say, wait a minute, set priorities. You've got to work within a budget, set priorities, make security your first priority. You know, I'm in this report, what strikes me is the continuing failure, and the report draws attention to it, of the U.S. intelligence community. They talked about stovepipe discussions on decisions of regarding policy and security in Washington. One agency not talking to the other, the CIA not talking to the State Department. We've seen this over and over. That, too, has got to stop. You know, Tom, reportedly, I have it on good authority that Chuck Hagel, former senator from Nebraska, was to be named Secretary of Defense today. That's been put off. Hmm. Why? Well, because there's been a great deal of, sort of adverse publicity given him, led by AIPAC and other groups saying, you're not friendly to Israel. You've said things about Israel and, quote, unquote, the Israeli lobby that are unforgivable. Meanwhile, other groups like J Street have said, no, this man's a fine, be an excellent Secretary of Defense. The thing is, if the president doesn't go ahead with this appointment,
and this would be a kind of a bipartisan outreach move if it had happened, or does happen.
It would absolutely be a bipartisan outreach. But if he doesn't go ahead with it because of this pressure, that will be a very bad sign about his leadership.
Rick, Molly, do you have anything on the Hagel front? Do you see that?
Oh, I think the president clearly wanted to make this announcement all at the same time, and I think he is running into more flack than he calculated on Senator Hagel
from AIPAC on his positions on lobbying Israel. Is that
Yes, it's primarily on that front, but you also see others like Senator McCain pointing out that Chuck Hagel really wasn't a Republican by the end of his tenure there. So I think the folks on the AIPAC side of things, they view the best opportunity to stop this nomination as occurring before it happens. They feel like because of the bipartisan nature of an appointment like that, it would be hard to stop Senator Hagel from being confirmed by his former colleagues. But I think it is an unexpected level of resistance that has delayed the complete filling out of the Obama second term.
And what a level of power. Standing in front of the U.S. Senate and its advice and consent there. We'll see what more we learn on that front. Molly Ball, here we are. Do you expect to be covering fiscal cliff work next week, Molly?
I personally am going on vacation.
And the Molly Ball
fortunately
clause.
Fortunately for all the reporters and congressmen, they are at least off until after Christmas. But they'll be back. This isn't over. Nobody's going home till New Year's, I don't think.
What a year's end. I do not recall another quite like it. Tragedy and so much uncertainty on that front. Grateful to all of you for being with us today. Molly Ball with The Atlantic joining us from Washington. Thank you very much for being here, Molly.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC News. Thank you, Rick.
My pleasure.
And Jack, thank you very much, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.